A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Hey, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights are probably gone.
So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Hello, and welcome to episode 1 of British Invaders. This is Brian from Winnipeg in Canada.
And this is Xander from London, England.
Today we will be talking about Sapphire and Steel, which was a late 70s, early 1980s science fiction TV series that dealt with disturbances in time and the people or the entities who fix and repair those disturbances. It was not about time travel. It was not about people going into the past and changing things or anything like that. It was about anomalies where things from outside of time would enter into time and cause all kinds of problems. And to deal with these problems, you had two characters, Sapphire, who was a woman, and Steel, who is a man, who would come seemingly out of nowhere at the beginning of each story, shortly after the disturbance occurred, and deal with that disturbance, and over the course of the program, they would fix it. This may sound like a strange concept for a show, and it was a bit of a strange concept, but it gave a great mysterious feel and some very interesting storytelling.
Sapphire and Steel was on the late 70s, early 80s. It was actually on from 1979 to 1982, and it was actually broadcast twice a week in the evening at 7 or 8. It didn't really have seasons because it was broadcast intermittently, I guess, and there weren't that many stories, so you can't really divide it into seasons. There were basically 6 stories, and it was reasonably popular from the beginning, probably partly due to the cast, which was really well known, which we'll talk about later, I guess. Its ratings started at 22% of the possible audience, which is, I think, of all people with televisions, not just people who had the TV on at that time, so that's quite a big audience. And it did trail off towards the end, where it had 16% in the last series. To give a bit of background, this time was about the same time that Doctor Who was at its peak. Sapphire and Steel was on ITV, which is the commercial channel, which is the rival to BBC, which had Doctor Who. So it may have been sort of thought of as a rival to Doctor Who. And it is about time, but as Brian said, it handles it very differently, so it's not really similar to Doctor Who.
Yes, they were both big science fiction series that had a mysterious sort of aspect. There was a much stronger current of mystery in Sapphire and Steel than there was in Doctor Who, and than you have in most other series.
Yeah, I mean, much less is explained. I mean, in Doctor Who, by the end of a story, however long it is, you almost know everything that was going on, whereas Sapphire and Steel, it's very vague, certainly at the beginning of a story, and even at the end of the story, it's not necessarily clear exactly what the truth is, and at the end of the whole TV series, you really don't understand exactly what Sapphire and Steel are.
Now what?
The time of year now.
Late October, why?
Not here. Not on this platform.
What?
It's summer.
Summer?
Yes, can you feel it? It's a summer night. Can you feel the warmth?
No.
And the air. It's filled with the smell of flowers. And trees. The movement of them. And the smell of newly cut grass.
What time period?
I don't know.
The source?
I can't tell. It's just that it doesn't seem malevolent. The sensation of warmth and calmness.
It is malevolent. It has to be. Sapphire, there are no trees, there are no flowers. There's only you and I, it, and a man.
So of the two major characters you had in Sapphire and Steel, Steel, who was played by David McCallum, was the stoic and harsh type of character of the two. He was, roughly speaking, the leader of the two of them, but it was not clearly defined if he was the one who was really in charge, but he always seemed to be the one laying out what the plan was. He always was very abrupt in how he dealt with people, with the humans who were involved. He was the brute force person whenever there was one needed. He was the one who would make the challenging decisions, and often what would come in with his abilities, or if you will, powers, although they weren't played like superpowers. He had abilities like very significant strength, and he was able to cool himself down to be very cold like steel, to affect some of the anomalies and invaders from outside of time. He also had some telekinetic abilities, so he was able to influence things in a very sort of harsh, direct way. He was always the cold and directed and hard member of the duo that we had.
In contrast, Sapphire, who was a woman, played by Joanna Lumley, was much more diplomatic. I mean, she dealt, basically, Steel actually deferred to her when dealing, mostly in the dealings with the people that they encountered in this, in the adventures. She was much better at handling people and finding out things from them, what they need to know to try and solve things. She had slightly different powers to Steel. The main thing that she had, because she could actually roll back time, but only by 10 minutes, I think it was. So in certain things where something had gone wrong in them trying to fix whatever the problem was, they could actually go back and have another go. She also sometimes seemed to be able to control the normal humans, or at least put suggestions in their heads. But the other thing is, both characters are telepathic and they talk to each other by telepathy. So as Brian says, Steel is very driven to just get on with trying to solve the problem and doesn't really care about the people involved, just wants to fix it, whereas Sapphire seems to be more caring and also often does the talking to the people.
It was a very interesting contrast between the two characters, because behind everything, you knew that the two of them were really working towards the same purpose, and they were really very well aligned in what they were doing. They weren't in conflict with each other very much. Their objectives were always the same, but their approach could be so different from one from the other. It was also, yeah, because they had the telepathy element of it, you could see their relationship and how they were relating one to the other, and then how, yeah, they were talking to the humans. And when they're talking to each other, they're always on the same page and they're very similar in many ways. But when they're talking to the humans, they're almost at opposite ends of the spectrum, which was a nice little contrast. Those types of things were done quite well. Another thing that was also done very well in the series, and one of the reasons that I like it so much, is the mysterious quality to the characters. When I talk about the mysterious quality, there is more than one type of mystery in television. You have the murder mystery, where you have a puzzle set up at the beginning of the episode, and by the end it's solved and you know everything. There is something else that occurs where you have mysterious characters, and there are just many things that you don't know about them. You don't know their motivations, you don't necessarily know their background or where they came from, and that was the case in Sapphire and Steel with the main characters. That is something that you see fairly often in British fiction, but you don't see it that often. Certainly in American television, you don't see it very often. In British television, it was a part of Doctor Who in the early years in the 1960s. It was also, I think, very much a part of Sherlock Holmes, that you knew very little about Sherlock Holmes. You knew some things, but you didn't know why he had all these skills. There was a lot about his background that you didn't know. Sapphire and Steel are very much like that as well. You don't really know who they are or what they are. They are certainly not human. They are agents who are sent from somewhere by someone or something to fix these temporal anomalies. You don't know who they work for, what their backgrounds are, really what their motivations are. It's really very mysterious types of characters, and that helped lend a very nice texture and sense of ambiance to the series. In the opening credit narration, they talk about the elements and then go to talk about the different agents with things like gold and lead and so on. Among them, you have things that are not elements at all, including sapphire and steel, and also jet and a couple of others.
Yeah.
It was an interesting decision that they talk about them being elements and then go and make them not be elements in the chemical sense at all.
Yeah, that's one thing I spotted almost straight away being a scientist. The other thing is that you, in the last episode, which we'll talk about a bit more later, they have some opponents that are referred to as transient beings. Again, it's not really explained what they are, although they have similar powers. And I think they even say they're the same as us. So they're of a similar nature. And they even refer to as serving a higher power, which is odd, considering Sapphire and Steel are sort of the good guys, or at least the good guys as far as fixing time is concerned. So it's all a bit odd. And the other thing is that the opening narration refers to the transuranic elements as not being suitable for use where life is, or something, words to that effect. And my sort of speculation is, are they the same thing? But there's very little, well, there's no information about any of this stuff. So it lends itself to speculation, because very little is explained. Basically, you know, they have powers which you get seen. They make some comments about having briefings and being sent. This upset in time has been detected somehow by means we don't know, and they arrive, and we know very little about them. And that, I think that makes it more interesting, because often when things are explained, actually the explanation isn't as interesting as this, as what comes up in your own imagination.
I think it's actually a great advantage to the series that there is so little that you know. I think that really adds a great deal of style and makes it very interesting. It makes it timeless in a way that it might not be otherwise. You had to be pretty patient when they were on originally, because you'd have 4 or 6 or 8 episodes and they'd be spread out over a few weeks and you'd just get it 25 minutes at a time.
Well, that's Doctor Who. Well, it's better than Doctor Who. Doctor Who was the same length episodes.
And they were once a week, right?
At the time, and they were once a week. So you could say it's a step up from Doctor Who back then. So it's not that surprising. And the other thing, sorry, to comment, was that ITV was an advertising channel. So obviously they say it was a 25-minute program, but I guess it was in a half-hour slot.
What I thought was interesting, and where it differs from Doctor Who, is that each episode was really written separately, where if you look at the Doctor Who serials, it's more like one long program that was divided up. There's much more of a separation between each episode and one of the serials of Sapphire and Steel. Really, to get the most out of them, you want to watch each episode separately, watching it over a few days or watching something else in between episodes. It really felt like they each told a part of the story, but each sort of had to sit on its own, or it didn't flow quite properly. I know at a couple of points in the U.S., I believe it was that they showed Sapphire and Steel and showed each serial re-edited into one long movie format. I saw one of them like that at one point and found it hard to follow. It meandered a lot and didn't make that much sense. Then when I saw it in the individual episodes, it made much more sense, because each episode had one high point and had one revelation and added something to the progression of the plot. So if you're watching Sapphire and Steel, I would recommend watching it episode by episode rather than sitting down and watching all of them in a row.
Well, they tend to have a cliffhanger at the end of every, apart from obviously the last one, the end of every half-hour episode, although some of the cliffhangers are a little
forced.
Yes.
I thought anyway. But often there is a cliffhanger or a revelation of some sort that's sort of a dramatic point.
Now, the look of Sapphire and Steel is fairly minimalist. I find it looks quite a bit like a live theater production that is filmed and has different cameras and so on. But it feels quite a bit like live theater because you have one main set for each serial, and it's usually a fairly complex set. It's really several sets, but one main building, be it a house or a railway station, one place that the story is involved in, and it moves around, has almost a claustrophobic feel at times within that. The effects are very minimal, but the general feeling that you get is something that moves around these simple sets. A number of the sets have staircases that they film on. In fact, one episode of the first serial, I believe it was episode 3, was filmed almost entirely on the staircase. It didn't seem awkward. I barely even noticed that until it was mentioned somewhere else, and I went back, and sure enough, that episode is almost entirely on the stairs. The whole thing is dealing with these tight locations and these very small involved things. That and the general direction and the music and so on gives you an eerie sort of feeling. You have the mysterious aspect we've talked about already. What it adds up to is something like science fiction ghost stories. That is the best analogy for me, that it feels like live theater, but they're really like science fiction ghost stories. They have all of the mystery and the eerie quality and the claustrophobic tightness that you would look for in a ghost story.
It's almost all shot on in studio. I mean, there's actually one episode where there are some scenes outdoors, which are real location footage. It's the third serial, when they're on a roof of a car block. It makes it very claustrophobic. But the sets are, I think, of quite good high quality as well, because it's basically all contemporary with the time that it was filmed. There are some bits where you get things going back in time, but there's no trying to do something futuristic, which means it doesn't date. And also, I think set dressers are much better at producing things that look either current or from the past, and trying to do something for the future is very hit and miss, as you can see in things like Doctor Who, whereas in this, because it's basically contemporary, they don't have any of those problems of trying to make futuristic sets. So again, I think it comes off very well, and the lighting is in most part subdued, which helps you, doesn't show off, you know, the fact that it's a set, that it looks more like a real location. And there are some special effects, but actually I think the special effects are very subdued again, and actually I think they stand up. I mean, obviously they did what they could do with what was available at the time, but they work. And I don't, you know, you wouldn't go back and say, oh, that, you know, that sort of jump makes you jump out of the story and say, oh, that's a bad special effect. In most cases, they actually work.
I agree. I think making Sapphire and Steel a big effects show would have been a big mistake. The simplicity of what they were doing was part of what made it so strong and so unique. And they did have things that, yes, you can see that they were inexpensive and that they were simple. At the same time, it was effective. So the big thing that people talk about is in the first serial, the villains, if you will, the thinking or sentient anomaly was shown as a spotlight on the floor. So you saw this little spotlight moving around on the floor, and that was your villain, which obviously is a pretty simplistic effect, but I think it was pretty effective. Doing something more complicated than fancier, I think, wouldn't have added much, if anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost more what the things did to other things or other people was the effect rather than the effect itself.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Seb.
We host the UK's largest Doctor Who and Torchwood podcast, the DWO WhoCast.
It's a weekly show where we talk about all the Doctor Who and Torchwood related news and reviews.
And we have exclusive behind the scenes interviews with cast and crew.
So, if you're looking for a podcast where you're as much a part of the experience as the hosts,
then why not try out the DWO WhoCast at www.thewhocast.com or www.drwho-online.co.uk.
The DWO WhoCast, the Doctor Who and Torchwood podcast.
One thing that stands out is that the operatives, agents, Saffron Steel, are very willing to do things that humans would see as wrong, I guess, to fix the problem with time. In the first story, that doesn't really come out, and we might talk about why that might be different later on. But quite a few of the other stories, the people who are pulled up in the event, the real people, are not necessarily helped, or in fact, in one case, they are definitely harmed by the decisions that Saffron Steel make to fix the problem with time. Obviously, they consider that time breaking down is, you know, a threat to, well, I suppose, to the whole universe, so that is much more important than maybe one or two people that are involved. But from the point of view as a sort of human observer, certainly first time it happened, I find it quite shocking, actually, that they are willing to go as far as they did for this abstract cause of fixing time. But from obviously from their point of view, they would maybe see it differently.
The second assignment ended with a moment of what was not only morally questionable, but at that point really seemed quite wrong how they resolved it. The first time I watched it, I was at the end of it thinking, okay, they're going to say something, so that won't really be the end, that really he won't have done that and there'll be something else that says what he really did.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They just left it at that, then this is what they did.
Yeah.
It helped paint the characters of Saffire and Steel, particularly Steel, as very alien types of characters. Even though they appeared human, they had very alien ways of doing things. Even in the first serial, you had a little bit of that, and then it built and became a major part of it.
Yeah.
The first assignment of Saffire and Steel was set in an old house in rural England, and it begins with two children, Rob and Helen, and their parents. The parents are reading Helen a nursery rhyme or two. She's very young, and Rob is sitting doing his homework and looking at the clock. All of a sudden, all the clocks in the house stop. They have many, many clocks. The father collects them. Rob goes upstairs, and the parents are gone. Just in the middle of reading nursery rhymes, all of a sudden they're gone. In the midst of this, Saffire and Steel show up from nowhere. No car, no way of getting there. They're just there. And they basically make their way into the house and take charge and say, okay, this is what you're going to do, kids. And begin the process of saying what happens here. And it was, in fact, the nursery rhymes that were related to this whole cause of what went wrong with time. And this starts to set up the pattern of how the Saffire and Steel stories are built. You have one or two characters, Rob and Helen in this case, who are humans who are involved for the duration of the story. And you have something that is old or is anachronistic that causes a breach in time.
Yeah.
One thing that is quite unusual in Saffire and Steel is how fragile time is, and that something old showing up in the present can weaken time to allow something to break in. And in this case, it was nursery rhymes.
Yeah.
These everyday things, these nursery rhymes, gain this great power within the serial, and much of the serial relates to these nursery rhymes and what they were originally written about, and tying that into the present and allowing this damage to time. It must have been very unusual for people to see when it first came on, and I think it's still quite unusual. The second serial, Assignment 2, was set in a railway station, an old, disused railway station. Again, an old building that is common to it. The old thing that was tied to this in this case was the railway station itself. And there was a man called Tully who was in this abandoned railway station looking for ghosts. And Sapphire and Steel show up looking for the same thing, except the ghosts they're looking for aren't supernatural in the same way. They're the ghosts of this breach in time. There is an image of a person walking up and down the platform at the railway station. The railway station was used for people going off to join the army. That was what that serial was based on.
Serial 3 was very different from the first two, because the first two were dealing with old things, whereas Assignment 3 was very different. In fact, it was involved with people from the future who had obviously invented some sort of time travel, had sent some people into the present, being 1980s as it was then, to do some research on living in their past. They were, I think, they're from 1500 years in the future. They'd sent a family into their past, which is our present, and that was what was basically causing the anomaly, the fact that there are these people from the future trying to live in the present. But it's a very different feel of episode, and even the way that the creature or threat from the break in time was very different. I mean, the first two was seen to be that the thing was something from time that was breaking through the breach, whereas in episode 3 it was slightly different. It was basically all down to the way that the technology that the people had used to come back in time. The fourth story was, again, back to the more familiar setup of, it was actually an old junk shop was part of the location, and there was a flat that had been rented out to some people, and one of the two tenants of the flat had disappeared, and the landlord had disappeared. And the fact there was a new landlord that actually turns out to be a manifestation of one of these creatures that has broken through time. And it's all around, centered around photographs, because the old landlord was experimenting with mixing images of the past with the present, and this was again the sort of clash of the past and the present that caused the breach in time and allowed this creature to come through. The fifth episode was actually not written by the same writer as the rest of the series, and it had a different feel. It was basically a Agatha Christie style whodunit, but again with the same Sapphire and Steel background to it, that that people were dying not because, you know, a mundane murderer, but actually all to do with breaches in time. And that game was slightly different because it involved the whole location was sort of being sent back in time, because they were doing a recreation, a party was a recreation of a past specific time, and the whole place was almost transmuting into the previous time.
And it had a bigger cast too.
And it had the other thing, it had a much bigger cast, because it had this sort of standard sort of dinner party, 10 or more, I think it was more than that, 10 guests plus one manservant as well. So yeah, it was a big cast. The other thing I should mention is there was in episode 3, the one with the futuristic people, we had what was known as an operative turn up, which Sapphire and Steel calls themselves. They're called operatives or agents, and a technician turned up. That was it. A technician who was called Silver, who was one of the people mentioned in the opening narration before, and he was basically very good with technology and fixing things. And actually, he was the one that managed to get them into the screened, invisible to the outside view, at least. Flat, which the people of the future were in doing this experiment that had gone wrong. And he was a very different character from Sapphire and Steel. He was much more jovial and seemed to be having much more fun in what he was doing than both Sapphire and Steel. And he was much more easily distracted. I think he just enjoyed fiddling with things, and he had to be browbeaten a bit by Silver to get Steel to get him to get on with fixing the problem. The other thing was he was a little bit flirtatious with Sapphire as well. And I think it was intimated that they'd all worked before, or at least met each other before.
Yes, Silver was played by David Collins and played very well. It was a really neat addition to the dynamic of Lumley and McCallum that, you know, they were a very good team, and it was always a well-acted show. But Collins added a neat shift to the dynamics. He was one of two other agents that show up. There was also Lead, played by Val Pringle, who shows up in the first serial in the old house. And he was the sort of brute force character even more than Steel was.
Yeah.
And the muscle of the team in that one, and being Lead, he was also referred to as the insulation. So Assignment 6 is set in a roadside cafe which had been there since the 1940s or 50s, and there had been something else there before in the 1930s. Two people, a couple driving in the 1930s, ended up driving in, but being propelled from the 30s into the 1980s. Sapphire and Steel and Silver, again played by David Collins, showed up to solve this problem. And as the story goes on, they realize that it isn't a normal assignment, that there were a number of things that didn't seem to match with what they had been told originally. It develops to something that is a little bit different and finally ends on a big cliffhanger. We won't tell you what the cliffhanger was. Suffice it to say that it isn't a nicely resolved conclusion to the series. It's definitely an unresolved conclusion to the series. Something I enjoyed with Sapphire and Steel was that everyday things would be the things that would hold power in this series. There was a definite decision when the series was being developed not to use typical science fiction starships or ray guns or the typical fantasy things like magic rings and dragons and so on. It was a specific decision that they would not have those things, and that they would really deal with everyday things. So you have nursery rhymes in the first serial gaining this great power, and even the clocks have power to them, and in others, paintings and photographs and these old things, or things that incorporate old and new things, old buildings, become things that can have a great effect on time itself. That worked very well. It made it very different.
Yeah.
So you end up with things where the idea of trick photography, of taking an old photo and a new photo and making two people from different centuries look like they're standing together or something like that. That idea, the Sapphire and Steel, is horrific that anyone would do something like this because it's so dangerous. And it gave this great way of looking at time.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things, and it passes through all things. But you can't see it. And this sometimes, and it's dangerous.
Sapphire and Steel was created by P.J. Hammond, who wrote most of the serials, and Sean O'Riordan was the director and producer for most of the series. And he was also quite involved with the initial creation and pitching of the series. And it was an interesting evolution where they started. The original intention was to make it a children's series. You can actually see this when you look at the first serial. It has something of that feel. It was meant to be a science fiction for children. And when they were looking at casting for it, the director, Sean O'Riordan, told his casting director that he was looking for someone like David McCallum to play Steel. And his casting director said, well, why don't we ask David McCallum? And, you know, Reardon thought, well, he would never say yes. He's working in the States, and this is too small production for him. But they asked him, and sure enough, he said yes. So all of a sudden, they had a big name on this small production, and his salary was something like two or three times the casting budget that they had allocated for everyone for the series. So they had to get more casting budget. They had to find an actor to play Sapphire who was good enough to be to star across from David McCallum. And all of a sudden, they had something that was a much bigger series and a much bigger budget than what they were originally planning. In order to have that budget, it meant that they moved from a 5 p.m. time slot, you know, sort of after school children's fair, to a 7 or 8 p.m. slot, which was more of an older children's and adults kind of slot.
Yeah.
That meant that while this story that they had for the first serial was really written for children, and you had the two children as characters in it, it was filmed in a way, certainly the music, the lighting, even the acting and direction were not done for children. They were done for that 7 or 8 p.m. time slot. And it changed it altogether. So it was an interesting beginning for it.
The first story was written before it was cast, so they shot it more in an adult fashion, but it was a children-oriented script, and sort of the leads or co-leads were children, whereas in all the other stories, the people that are encountered are adults. So, and also, as you say, it gets more dark, because the second story we have this big amoral action by the lead characters, which you didn't have in the first story.
And the second story deals with war. The first story was dealing with nursery rhymes as a major element, which is something that children could relate to. But what they actually filmed was not a series for children.
A bit of background on the two leads which have been touched on. Joanna Lumley had just come off doing The New Avengers, which was the follow-up to The Avengers. I think it was a reasonably big series, and so she was already a big name from that. And I think she's been said that she wanted to do something very different after being this action woman agent in The New Avengers, and certainly Sapphire in Sapphire and Steel was very different, and I assume the casting of David McCallum didn't harm as well, because obviously he was a big name from being in the Man from U.N.C.L.E. I guess he was probably, certainly in the States, a much bigger name than Joanna Lumley was. So they both came off popular programs and came to this rather odd little British program, and I guess they were part of why it did so well straight off. It started off with very big viewing figures at the beginning, because they had these two big name leads in the role.
I think the whole series was really shaped around those two actors.
Yeah,
the characters were obviously written before they were involved, but once they became involved, they really made those characters their own.
Yeah.
As they continued writing the stories, it really fitted to those particular actors.
Yeah.
Listen, the kick-ass mystic ninjas, or we'll have to get mystic on your ass.
Ho, ha, guard, turn, parry, dodge, steal, ha, thrust.
The kick-ass mystic ninjas can only be found at www.kickassmysticninjas.com.
Spin-offs. What's come next? There was actually a novelization of Sapphire and Steel, which I think came out at the same time as a series. And it was actually written by P.J. Hammond, and it was a novelization of just the first story. Basically, it follows the plot of the script very closely. There's a few minor changes, apparently, but it's almost exactly the same. The other thing that has happened since Sapphire and Steel finished with this cliffhanger ending at the end of the sixth story is that recently there's a company called Big Finish, which does audio dramas. They're quite well known, at least in the UK, for doing audio dramas based on Doctor Who. And they've made audio dramas of Sapphire and Steel. And they, I think they approached the original stars but couldn't get them for whatever reason. And so they actually have recast Sapphire and Steel. It still is Sapphire and Steel, but they've got David Warner as Steel and Susanna Harker as Sapphire. And none of the stories have been written by PJ Hammond, so I don't know who owns the rights. I guess it must be the TV company or the successor to the TV company that made it, and Big Finish have bought the rights to produce them, but there's apparently no involvement from PJ Hammond, so they're new. I haven't heard any of them. I think the reviews I've seen are reasonably positive. Obviously, it's different with different actors in the roles.
Well, it must be quite different because of all the different personnel that are involved.
Yeah.
Although I believe David Collins does return to his role as Silver in one of the...
He does. Although someone, I think that I read a review where they comment he doesn't actually sound the same anymore because he's aged. But it is him doing the role. Yeah, he appears in one. There've been seven stories, and they had five stories in the first season. And they started a second season. There've been two stories, and I think Silver appears in one story of the first five. So yeah, he does reprise his role.
And this is a good 20-plus years since the original television series finished.
Yeah. I think these audio dramas have started been coming out only in the last few years. That's right.
Now, of course, Sapphire and Steel is available on DVD. I'm pleased to say that it's available on Region 1 in North America as well as Region 2. There are a number of British series that are worth watching but are only available on Region 2, which is in Europe and Japan. Sapphire and Steel, fortunately, is available both in the UK and in North America. I found that the DVD releases are quite good. They have a couple of commentaries and audio introductions for the various serials. I like them. They were good. I do want to make the comment that even though they call them audio introductions, you should really wait to listen to those after you've seen the serial they're talking about, because they do spoil things quite a bit. The individual cases for each DVD, blurbs on the back of them, also have more spoilers than they should. And even the titles, which are, I think, the original working titles, they don't display them on screen, but the working titles are there on the backs of the DVD cases, and even they have some spoilers in them. So I would recommend not reading any of the things about the individual serials from the cases or looking at the special features about them until you've watched the serial they're talking about. If you're really specific about spoilers and don't want anything spoiled, then watch all of the episodes before you look at any of the backs of the cases or any of the extra features.
The interesting thing is that the UK Region 2 DVDs actually have less on them than the Region 1 ones. We don't have the commentaries or the audio introductions. We have some text content. You have the original press releases, which were put out by the TV company that produced them at the time, and in fact those contain spoilers as well. So strangely enough, Region 1 is actually better than Region 2.
Now, something that I like to discuss for any older series that we talk about is, what about the possibility of the remake? Obviously, there is an audio remake of Sapphire and Steel that's being currently done. What about the possibility of doing an all-new Sapphire and Steel reimagined version? How would that work? Would it be worth watching? What do you think, Xander?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about the casting. Would you, if you could, get Dave McCallum and Joanna Lumley back? Or would you totally recast it like they have done for the audio drama? Because, as you said, it seems that the later episodes, the characters are very much written around the way that those two actors played the roles.
I think most of the episodes were.
Yeah.
So, even the later part of the first serial, I think they were.
Yeah, so... Yeah, would it work with different people? Obviously, they've aged, And that would have to be explained somehow if they did go down that route of casting them again and if they managed to get hold of them. But because they aren't human, I think that, you know, you could quite easily explain it, you know, away if you wanted to, or not explain it. I mean, that's the other thing. The way Saffron Steel works is that they don't explain things, so they could just pick up and carry on, and, you know, it's another mystery.
I think you're right. I think they could. All in all, I think that Sapphire and Steel is probably not a great candidate for a remake. It could work, especially if you had McCallum and Lumley back to do it. But I think it would be very hard to make it work in the current style of how dramas are done these days. At the time when it was being done originally, in Britain, they did a lot of things where they would film scenes as a whole scene. They would tend to rehearse a whole show and then record a whole show. And yeah. Each scene they would do in one take with several cameras. Instead yeah. of doing little pieces and a version with the camera looking in this direction, a version with the camera looking in that direction, they would do things in much more of a theatrical style, which is part of the reason that Sapphire and Steel looks quite a bit like live theater in many ways, because yeah. they were filming it much more like you would do live theater, but with a bunch of cameras there.
Yeah.
My tendency is to think that as much as I liked Sapphire and Steel, and I liked its slower style, I liked its high amount of detail and the way that they went through things and developed things in each episode, I liked how they did that a lot. But I can't see that working and being marketable now, just on the basis yeah. of what is out there now and how companies are doing things now. And yeah. the expectations of audiences now. So, sadly, I think this is probably not a great show to be remade, even though it was a very good series.
It probably would be a very different style of show if it was relaunched to make it, you know, commercially successful. It'd be a very different style of show. So, yeah, you know, whether you'd throw out the baby with the bathwater and it was just wouldn't be any good, I think it'd be very hard to tell. But it wouldn't be Sapphire and Steel as it was.
I'm Brad.
I'm Glenn.
And I'm Christina.
And we're from the Pod Culture Podcast and podculture.net.
When you're done here and you find yourself hungry for some more geeky goodness, head on over and check us out at podculture.net and at our forums located at bluegrassbrowncoats.net.
From A-plus shows to grade Z movies and everything else in between, like comics and video games, we'll be...
All.
So let your geek flag fly and head on out to our little corner of the verse.
www.podculture.net.
Pod Culture, equal opportunity geekness.
Be seeing you.
Now, in conclusion, Sapphire and Steel was a really neat, mysterious, eerie ghost story type of science fiction that dealt with distortions in time and these two alien entities called Sapphire and Steel, who are human in appearance, who would problem solve and fix these various anomalies and problems in breaks in time, and would do that through each serial. Now, as far as our recommendation for Sapphire and Steel, I will say that this was a great series. It's a classic. It's one of my favorite British science fiction shows. And anyone who likes that slower-moving, detailed, but very sort of eerie type of show, you should watch this for sure. If you're into only the faster-moving types of things, then maybe it isn't for you. But if you like something a little different, and if you like that ghost story, eerie kind of feel, then you will probably enjoy this, because it really was a solid series.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're looking for action, and bangs and special effects, you're not going to get it here. But if you're more sort of thoughtful, and if you're a theatre goer as well, because it is very theatrical, then it would be recommended.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, or you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. Our episode for next week will be about Star Cops. So thank you for joining us, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yeah, thank you very much, and goodbye from Xander.